This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about Abraham Lincoln and one aspect of Lincoln's career. Certainly, there would have been a time when he was early in his political career, when people might have dismissed him as simply a rough country lawyer, without the sophistication certainly required to rise to America's highest office. He did, of course, rise to that office. And according to our guest for this hour, Robert Ferguson, he's professor of law at Columbia University, Lincoln's rise was made possible by his skills as a public speaker. This morning in this hour, we'll talk a little bit about the qualities of Lincoln's eloquence, something that he has written about and something that he'll be talking about as part of a symposium on the campus, looking at Abraham Lincoln and different aspects of Lincoln, Lincoln and cultural value. There will be four speakers who will look at various aspects of Lincoln. This will be all taking place on Friday, the 7th of November, at the Tobridge. This is the Tobridge Office on American Literature, Culture, and Society is sponsoring this event. And it's going to be taking place this Friday. And it is something that is open to anybody who is interested. This is actually taking place at the Levis Faculty Center in the Music Room that's on the campus between 9 and 4. It's free and open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. That's the basic information. Our guest, Robert Ferguson, has written a good deal on American law and also pre-war, that is pre-Civil War, American literature. He is joining us this morning by telephone. Questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if people who are listening are interested in calling in and asking questions, making comments, they certainly are welcome to do that. Professor Ferguson, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
A gray, cloudy day in New York.
Well, it's pretty nice out here. I don't know what it's going to—I can't speak for what it's going to be like by the end of the week by the time you get here, but right at the moment here, certainly for today and for people going out to vote tomorrow, weather will not be an excuse for not getting out to exercise
that,
right? Well, I'm pleased that you can talk with us, and obviously here now we have been and we will be talking, in this program, but I'm also talking about Americans. We'll be talking a good deal about Abraham Lincoln now in the months ahead. And I think this is an interesting aspect of Lincoln to look at, because I think that we understand that he had a great ability to put words together. Of course, we don't know what it would have sounded like to hear him speak. The accounts are that he didn't actually have the most sonorous and impressive voice speaking. But when we see the words on the page, the elegance of the construction and compared to other people of the time, the simplicity, I think, really strikes us. Your argument seems to be that of all of the aspects of Lincoln, his character, his talents, this aspect, that is his ability to speak, was perhaps the key to his success as a politician and his election to the presidency.
Well, you have to understand that this was a man who had held higher office in 1848 for one term in Congress in a rather undistinguished session where he was basically known for unwisely opposing the Mexican War. And in 1860, he nonetheless becomes president, the nominee for president, basically on a number of speeches that he gives. And he also, I should add, fails to attain higher office between 1848 and 1860, tries twice and doesn't make it for a variety of reasons. I should add that it's probably a miracle that Lincoln got the nomination. If the convention had not been held in Chicago, if it had been held in St. Louis, if his supporters hadn't created the famous wigwam at the Chicago convention, if Stephen Douglas hadn't been his opponent, Lincoln probably wouldn't have gotten the nomination. He had no executive experience, something that is talked about today in our own election. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty much entirely on the basis of about 10 speeches that he gave while holding no public office that made him the Republican nominee and then president.
And just something that perhaps I may have known but certainly learned recently when talking with Harold Holzer about a recent book that he had written about Lincoln, is that at this time, people did not campaign for the nomination. He did not even appear at the nominating convention.
He wanted to go desperately and was told to stay away. But you're right that not only did one not campaign for the nomination, but one did not campaign personally thereafter. I mean, mm-hmm. Lincoln was told to stay at home and to let others take care of the campaigning.
It was seen to be unseemly to appear that you were actually seeking the nomination, or for that matter, would be seeking the post.
That's right. Lincoln worked a lot behind the scenes. He was a very talented politician, and like politicians today, he had his records of who was voting and who to speak to, who to write to, and how to work with the people around him. Many of the people around him disagreed with each other. Lincoln was the hub. He made sure that they did what they said they were going to do and that they cooperated enough. But like in every campaign, the people around him were rivals as well as supporters.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that one always hears, the part of the story that we are told about Lincoln, is that he was almost exclusively self-educated.
Correct.
That he certainly did go to spend some time attending a public school of the time. But in terms of who he was and what he achieved, what he knew about the law, what he knew about how to catch people's attention and how to construct arguments either in the courtroom or at the podium, all of this he taught himself. And it still, to me, is a remarkable thing that he could manage to achieve this.
Well, Lincoln was both proud of the fact, I mean, he said when asked in a campaign biography, "I studied with no one," but also somewhat ashamed of his education. He spoke of it as being defective. What it did do was to make him work that much harder. He had a very analytical kind of mind, and he was not a widely read man, but he was a very deeply read man in Blackstone, Shakespeare, the Bible, and various manuals of elocution and grammar that he virtually memorized to the point where he understood exactly how certain things were done through thought. He memorized and worked through Euclid's principles just as an exercise. So he worked very hard to make himself as educated as he could be. And like many an autodidact, he had a certain mechanical approach to things, but then there was this incredible creative energy that he brought to the process, transforming many of those devices in his actual letters and speeches.
Mm-hmm. I think that also that you really make the argument that his experience as a courtroom attorney, very broad, and I was really surprised. I had the opportunity to read the paper that you're going to present, and in here there were some figures, and I'm now looking for them.
I should know
about how many times he argued in court. Just a staggering number of times.
The 5,000 cases across 24 years, and people call him a country lawyer, but he argued 333 times before the Supreme Court of Illinois, which would have been an appellate case. So that Lincoln was, there are debates about this. Lincoln was clearly a very accomplished lawyer, but the profession was changing quite dramatically in the antebellum period, and some younger lawyers who were getting into corporate work wondered about Lincoln's staying abreast, but he was a very good railroad lawyer, and he was a pragmatist in terms of his approach to these matters. I would say that it was through the courtroom that he learned how to make a speech. He said as much. He said, if you want to be a lawyer, you have to be able to give a speech.
And he said, I think he said, you have to be able to, what we would say, speak off the cuff. I mean, he would say,
right.
Not only do you have to be able to construct a speech and deliver it, but you have to be able to speak to speak extemporaneously, and that's something he in his advice to other people who were either lawyers or wanted to be lawyers, he said to them, this is something that you need to be able to do.
That is correct, and it also applied in the political forum. In that day and age, before these huge rallies, speakers were constantly interrupted with questions, which they were expected to field and to respond, and Lincoln was very quick in these kinds of responses. We're talking about a very intelligent man.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Robert Ferguson. He is George Edward Woodbury Professor in Law, Literature, and Criticism at Columbia University. We'll be here on the campus near the end of the week, at the end of the week, to talk about Abraham Lincoln and his talent as a speaker, which he says was key to his political success. This is part of a colloquium that looks at different aspects of Abraham Lincoln's, taking place on Friday from 9 to 4 at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. It's open to anybody who would like to attend, so you should certainly feel welcome if you're interested. His, I think, will be the lead-off presentation early in the morning, and you're certainly welcome to stop by. Also here, of course, on this program, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you remark on in this paper that I mentioned is that you have to understand Lincoln's ability as a speaker, you have to understand what it meant to make a speech at that time. And there, so not only then can you understand how well Lincoln could embody the approach of the time, and yet that he also did, he went beyond that in a sense, perhaps in a way that makes it easier for us now to read his speeches and identify with his rhetorical style than other people who would at the time have been considered to be great speakers.
Well, at that time, people spoke at great length. It was not unusual for someone to hold forth for 2 hours. The crowds were huge. These were the rock stars of their day. The newspapers would described the number of women who fainted during performances, and people would, for example, in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, they stood outside in the rain for 3 hours listening to Lincoln and Douglas debate the senatorial campaign of 1858. What Lincoln did as president was to compress what were understood to be certain structures within oratory, which really come from classical times. And so you can see the structure in his speeches much more easily than you can in some of those long performances. It was his talent to understand when to speak and when not to speak. One of the greatest talents a lawyer can have is knowing what not to say. And Lincoln was very clear about this, that you didn't say anything that you couldn't prove. And it helped him, I think, toward a level of concision and also toward a level of plain speech, which was not, of course, the norm of the day.
There were certain things that were very important for him in learning to speak, how you construct a speech. Things that he drew on for inspiration.
Right.
Certainly, there were books about giving speeches and so forth.
Right.
Also important for him were, as I'm sure would have been for other people of the time, was the Bible and the works of Shakespeare. There's something else that I'd like to have you talk about, because this is something that I'm not familiar with. This was a book that I guess everybody at the time, or lawyers at the time, would have known about. This is Commentaries on the Laws of England by William Blackstone.
Right.
And apparently at the time, if you called somebody a Blackstone lawyer, was maybe not said to be a particular compliment. And in fact, I think in something else that I read that you wrote, you said something like maybe Lincoln was the last Blackstone lawyer to be president, something like that.
Right. See, William Blackstone wrote his commentaries for English gentlemen between 1765 and 1769, but it sold much more powerfully in America, because Blackstone's major claim was that you could use law to map a country. You can understand how powerful this was in the developing of the United States, where you had territories, wilderness, undeveloped areas. Lincoln bought into this notion, but you're right that Blackstone lawyer often was used pejoratively. It signified that you were only lightly educated, but many lawyers in that period basically used this book. To give you an example, Lincoln's opponent, Stephen Douglas, traveled just far enough west that he could be admitted to the bar immediately on very little learning, which is why he ended up in Illinois. So we're talking about a period where the law was changing very, very rapidly. One of Lincoln's great talents was that he did change with the times. It was Horace Greeley who said, "This is a man who probably developed intellectually in every single year of his life." That's a major statement. How many of us can make it?
Mm. We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Someone in Mattoon. This is our line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, I'm interested in your topic, and I totally agree that Lincoln was a self-taught, probably genius in many ways in his linguistic abilities. I'm just wondering sometimes if you could comment. I know this may be but the fact that we sometimes revere leaders when they are successful or they die tragically, and in this particular case, it's a kind of a both scenarios. But I think Lincoln is extremely good at politics, and one of the things that we understand about the man is that the famous letter that a little girl wrote, that my brothers would vote for you if you had a beard. And I think he was a man, as you pointed out very astutely, aware of the times, the media, the telegraph, knowing how short messages, or at least his speeches were not. Like, for example, the Gettysburg Address was considerably shorter than his counterpart that talked during the same time. But I think he was a genius in the sense of what would work. But at the same time, I'd like to minimize a little bit of him because of his success. Would we study him intently today and revere him as much if it wasn't for the fact that the Civil War was won and all the events that occurred during that time?
Well, let me respond to that. I think you have a point that Lincoln is assassinated on Good Friday. There are many references to Christ right at the end of the war. What would we think of him if he had to deal with Reconstruction and a recalcitrant Congress for 4 years? Lincoln, during his lifetime, was lampooned a great deal and criticized, ridiculed. He was an awkward speaker. He had a high voice. It carried well, but it wasn't particularly attractive. He spoke with a twang. Many in the East made fun of him. So eloquence is a matter of circumstance and as much as performance. And Lincoln made the most of the circumstances he had. I'll point to one other factor in which your point applies. He was the first president to use the newspapers directly to respond to criticism, to put letters in the newspaper, to respond to his critics, and he did it extremely adroitly. All of that said, you have to understand what an enormous task this man faced. When he left Springfield, he said, I have a task that is greater than George Washington's, and I think it was, and certainly as president.
We are almost at our midpoint here. Other questions are certainly welcome. We're talking this morning with Robert Ferguson. He is professor of law, literature, and criticism at Columbia University. And we're talking here about Lincoln and his ability as a speaker. And our guest is going to be here at the end of the week to take part in a colloquium looking at Lincoln. There'll be 4 different speakers looking at different aspects of Abraham Lincoln. This is taking place on Friday from 9 to 4 at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus in the music room. It's open to anybody who would like to attend. And certainly people who are listening are welcome to stop by. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something that I am interested in having you reflect on, and you know, we certainly acknowledge the the eloquence of this man. And we do that in a time when it seems that we, or at least some people, have become suspicious of eloquence on the part of politicians, to the point where it's something that's can be used as a criticism, an attack almost. If somebody is smooth, then we somehow say, well, there's got to be something wrong with that.
Or we call them professorial.
There's nothing wrong with being professorial. And I'm interested in that, how it is that on the one hand we seem to honor and appreciate rhetorical eloquence, and at the same time we somehow think that there's something suspicious about it, or we somehow want to doubt that person's genuineness.
Well, I think it is a major criticism, and it's why I wrote this paper in part. I think it's just true that eloquence is not quite what it was in today's political forum. There are a number of reasons for that. It's very hard to think of a recent presidential speech that one would call memorable. There are one-lines from speeches that we recall, and part of the problem is that the development of argument is not as carefully wrought in terms of the structure of a speech as it was before. People tend to have a grab-bag approach to try and reach a very diverse population, whereas I think in earlier eras, there were one or two themes that people worked through very carefully. I think there's another problem that is technological. Television is a dangerous medium for speech, and here's why. It is at once cool in the sense that if you're at a rally and listening to a speaker, you can get caught up. If you're watching on television, you're one click away from another channel, and you're sitting in your chair in a very different mode. But at the same time, television encourages a kind of false intimacy. It's as if you know the person. And this leads people on television to try and be intimate in a way that I think comes across falsely to many listeners.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else in Urbana here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. My name's Brian. Happy to hear Professor Ferguson. I was a student of his at Columbia.
Is this Brian Selkeld?
Yes, yeah.
How you do, Brian?
Doing fine, and it's great to hear you again, Professor. You touched on an issue of Lincoln and his audience having a shared vocabulary or a shared knowledge of certain texts, such as the Bible, Shakespeare, classical Greek and Latin texts, and Blackstone, of course. And it seems that that it's far less likely that a politician speaking today can encounter that sort of an audience, or is less likely to have an audience familiar with a common body of texts. And I was wondering if that may impede the ability of a of speakers to communicate eloquently in the manner that Lincoln did.
Well, we do have a much broader range of newspapers today, and that, I think, is the common language that people turn to. But you're correct. Many of Lincoln's late speeches depend very much on a Bible culture. In the second inaugural, when he says God will punish, and therefore we need not at the end of the war. And he quotes something like four biblical passages in that very short second inaugural. It's the second shortest inaugural speech ever given. Many people, including Frederick Douglass, saw it as a sermon rather than a political speech. So I think that is a very big difference, that the religiosity of the crowds around Lincoln was quite palpable, but that didn't mean that religion was a unifying factor. There were many divisions then as now between denominational sects. What's interesting about Lincoln, I think, is that he belonged to no church, which was a problem for him and would be a problem in politics today, but he had his own take on religious language, and was very reflective about theological matters. And that, I think, allowed him to speak to all denominational all the denominations around him, instead of having to select one orthodoxy or one dogma.
Okay. Yeah, well, thank you, Professor, and look forward to seeing you on Friday.
Thank you.
Well, thanks.
Take care,
Brian.
Okay.
Again, other people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
You know, one other thing I would say about Lincoln's language is the musicality of it. Many scholars have actually taken his short speeches and arranged them almost as poetry. He often claimed that he could not understand unless he heard words as well as seeing them, and so that there's the rhythms of Lincoln's speech are one of the things that I think make them timeless, and I think that may be a lost aspect of speech today as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in perhaps going back to this point that there was a shared vocabulary, perhaps, or a shared kind of base of knowledge that Lincoln would have drawn on to make his speeches and that people listening would have been familiar with, and perhaps something that everybody would have been familiar with at that time was the Bible, certainly. I'm thinking, though, about the fact that the audience wouldn't always be quite the same in this sense. The speech, I think a lot of people would say the speech that made it possible for him to secure the nomination was the Cooper Union speech.
Exactly.
In New York. And here he was speaking to probably a fairly select audience of elites, in a sense trying to introduce himself to them so that they might indeed get the idea that this man was presidential quality material. If you also think about, say, something like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which were attended by, I would think, a sort of broader range of people, and in fact, at the time, speech-making like that, events like that, were popular entertainment.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
They were things that people, you know, went to because that was, you know, it was a free show, in a sense. Would the audience for an event like that truly have been as in tune and have the kind of background that, say, those two audiences, would they in fact be equally clued in to any references that he might make that they would resonate with that? An audience like those that must have turned out for Cooper Union and then those people who turned out for the debates between Lincoln and Douglas.
Well, a good speaker is always aware of his audience. One of the accusations Douglas makes of Lincoln during the Lincoln-Douglas debates is that Lincoln changed his speeches for Southern Illinois as opposed to Northern Illinois. Mm-hmm. Southern Illinois at the time being in favor of slavery or more inclined to be in favor, whereas in the North they were against it. Lincoln was helped by the fact that there was a single issue that was tearing the country apart, slavery. But what you do see him doing is changing the sophistication of his presentation depending on where he is. One amusing thing about the Cooper Institute speech was it was immediately printed in all of the local newspapers and actually very widely in the Northeast, which is one of the things that helped get him the nomination. But he was asked to, and he went on a speaking tour in New England immediately after that, and he complained about how he had to keep arranging for a new speech rather than delivering the one he just gave. This was a general problem amongst orators of the period. Ralph Waldo Emerson has a famous comment where he says, the barber learns his trade on the orphan's chin. He would begin his speeches in very small villages to see how they would turn out, and then only after he had perfected it, deliver it in the big cities. You can accuse Lincoln sort of doing that a little bit as well. So Emerson was always very unhappy when the local speech was printed in the newspaper. So Lincoln was very mindful that his Eastern audience would be different from the Western audience, and he toned down some of the jokes, some of the earthiness, one of the things that surprised his Eastern audience at Cooper Union was the notion that this was a very sophisticated man and not a rube from the West.
Yeah. That, you know, that's interesting. It makes me the story about the text of your because here we're at a time where we're starting to see the beginnings of mass communications,
exactly.
And the technology that made it possible for someone to to give a speech somewhere and then for that speech to be reproduced fairly quickly and published in newspapers. And it just actually my mind goes to the stories also about Mark Twain. When he would travel around, he got irritated because he would be in one town and he would do his thing. He would do a talk and do a presentation. But then the problem was he'd get to the next place and they were reading what he had done at the last stop. And so he was irritated because he had to do something new. He couldn't do the same thing over and over again because when you got to the new place, the people would have heard it already.
Well, you know, the Lincoln-Douglas debates are the first speeches in America where newspapers send reporters who transcribe what was being said. Lincoln, in fact, is the one who collects those speeches, and despite their similarity across, there were seven speeches across the state between August and October, he arranged for them to be printed, not just in English, but in German. But one reason he did so is if you look at those debates, Douglas seems to get the better of him in the early speeches, but Lincoln becomes more and more powerful as the debates go on. And in the last two, it's very clear that Lincoln's own speeches, despite all of the repetitions that crossed those seven speeches, have improved mightily, and I think he was very interested in people seeing that development.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also that you would likely tie this back to his experience in the courtroom, perhaps.
Yes.
Arguing that one of the things that you learn as a lawyer making arguments is you've got to hone in, you've got to have a central point that you've got to really stick to, and you may indeed make concessions about other things you think aren't maybe quite as important, as long as you can continue to hone in on that central argument that you want to make.
Lincoln was famous for this. He was a lawyer who believed in settling wherever possible instead of drawing things out, and he was quite willing to give up peripheral matters for what he called the nub of the issue. And you can see that in the speeches. You can see it most strongly in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, but you can also see it in even the Gettysburg Address and in the second inaugural, where he pares away the things he's not going to talk about and then very quickly homes in on what he thinks is really important in that moment.
Perhaps we could talk just a little bit, or I could ask you to talk just a little bit more about the Gettysburg Address. It's fortunate it's short enough, so it's the kind of thing that people are familiar with, and many people have memorized it, and it's memorizable in part not only because of the musicality of the language, but that it's not all that long. But that you can use that to illustrate how people at the time were taught to structure speeches, and that in fact that it in very concise form will show you exactly how you're supposed to do that, or at least how in classical terms people were instructed in how a speech was to be put together.
Well, there are several devices there. My favorite is Lincoln's use of implied questions in the Gettysburg Address, where he— this is a famous device from classical times that lawyers use in America. It's called hypophora, and it's asking the question in exactly the way that you want the person to respond. And Lincoln asks two questions here. He asks, first of all, can the nation long endure in such a civil war, a nation so conceived and dedicated to liberty? And second, did those at Gettysburg die in vain? Now, both of these are questions that people want to reject in the sense of the negative answers. And Lincoln designs his speech so that you go from those dangerous questions to a refutation of them. So there are many devices by which he does it in this very short speech. One of them is through the classical forms of oratory that where you had very fixed opening. Then you had a narrative which was to grab people. Then you had a kind of narrative of what was at stake, which is what you get in the second short paragraph. And then you had a proof against refutation, and finally a finish that would rouse people and send them off with a feeling of affirmation, which is what the ending of the Gettysburg Address does. So that what one would have generally in oratory in the period is an hour speech where people would wait for these separate moments to come. What Lincoln does is to condense them into 271 words. But a number of newspaper people recognized the quality of this speech. There's a big debate about that. Did people understand what the Gettysburg Address meant when it was delivered? Some did and some didn't. That's the way of the world.
This is, I think that probably people are sort of used to this idea also that this was something that he tossed off really very quickly, that it was something that was hastily put together, that he, in a spare moment or two, scribbled it out and then gave it. And I'm not sure that that's doing justice to the speech or
nothing
to him.
Nothing that Lincoln ever did was done hastily. He was, in that sense, a very, very careful planner. We know that he worked on the Gettysburg Address for the better part of a month, which is all he had when he was asked to speak. And the second inaugural, that is true as well. He typically it's interesting how Lincoln changed many of the presidential genres. The message to Congress, which became the State of the Union message, used to be a very dry report of facts. Lincoln is the one who turns it into an oratorical performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of that is because of the times, the circumstances that he faced. And I should say that in order to be eloquent, you also need a situation that calls for it. That may have been some problems with recent presidents, that their situation did not, in a sense, demand something of them that obviously was demanded of Lincoln. Hmm.
Well, when this, just as a side point, when this thing that we now call the State of the Union began, the president, it wasn't something that the president went to Congress to deliver in person.
That is correct.
It was something that was written down and it was sent over to Congress in that fashion. Who was the first president to actually stand before the Congress and deliver the address?
I believe, I may be wrong about this, but I think it was Woodrow Wilson who changed that format. It's interesting why the original change was made. Thomas Jefferson, as our third president, had a stutter and did not like to deliver speeches. So he sent somebody over to deliver it for him, and that became the tradition. But somebody out there in your audience may correct me, but I think part of the excitement in Woodrow Wilson becoming president was that he went to Congress and gave his speech.
All right, let's talk with someone here calling from Mount Vernon, here in Illinois, on line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Very interesting show, enjoying it quite a bit. David, the name escapes me, but I want to say a couple of weeks ago, I think you had another author on talking about a different aspect of Lincoln's life. And what I wanted to ask your guest about was particularly the Wigwam Club in Chicago, and you
right.
mentioned the speeches there. I was just curious, you touched on it briefly, but was wondering if Chicago was a foregone conclusion for the convention. And, in fact, was it a done deal by the time they had it that they were going to nominate Lincoln? And if that's not the case, were there any memorable speeches in that event that Lincoln gave? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Sure. That's a very good question. In fact, the choice between St. Louis and Chicago came down to a single vote as to where the Republican convention would be held. You have to remember, this was still a new party and being called the Black Republicans. And so they hadn't quite gotten their act together, and there were a lot of very diverse people within it. The Wigwam Club obviously was tied to Lincoln's notion of being a rustic figure. He was not the obvious candidate. William Seward, the senator and governor of New York, was the definite front-runner and actually led in the first two rounds of voting. But each time, by calculation, Lincoln had more votes. The Wigwam Club, there was a huge teepee that was set up to signify the western roots of the Republican Party, was packed with Lincoln supporters. Lincoln's people made sure they got there early so that they filled the seats. And so that was something of a factor. Politics was a sort of rough-and-tumble game back then. Lincoln knew after the second ballot that he would likely win on the third, just by the arrangement of things. What would have happened if the election had been not in Chicago, not in the state of, if the convention had not been in Illinois, is an open question. I think there were many people who objected to Lincoln, and a lot, I think, depended on having a lot of people on the ground who were working for him.
All right. Other questions, welcome. We have maybe about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Robert Ferguson. He is a professor of law, literature, and criticism at Columbia University. And as I mentioned, he will be here in Champaign-Urbana at the end of the week to take part in an event, a colloquium, looking at various aspects of Lincoln and his life. And this will be taking place at the Levis Center on the campus in the music room. It's open to the public Friday, the 7th, from 9 to 4. And, of course, anybody, as I said, anybody who's interested can stop by. Questions are also welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And just, by the way, just for the record, you were correct that it was, in fact, Woodrow Wilson who was the one that apparently Washington actually gave a speech, gave the first one. Then Jefferson said no, he didn't want to do that, and then it was written down and taken to Congress, and then someone actually did read it out in the Congress, but it wasn't the president. It was Wilson who was the one who brought back this the practice of actually himself going.
I think even at the time there, when Wilson did this, there may have been criticisms of whether this was violating the separation of powers, but most people were excited about it, I think. Mm-hmm.
And again, other questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What else can we say about Lincoln as a speaker? There's some aspects here that we haven't quite touched on yet.
Well, there's the humor. Lincoln, I think this was very important for Lincoln as president. The thing about humor is that it takes you a little outside of yourself and gives you a better perspective. Lincoln was criticized for this, for saying humorous things during the war, but I think it was a very powerful corrective for him in terms of keeping his own feet on the ground, particularly in dealing with his generals. I'll mention just one of those. He had a lot of difficulty with people were learning how to fight this war at the same time that everybody thought they knew exactly how to save the Union. And Lincoln had a lot of trouble controlling many of these people on the ground, one of whom was W.S. Rosecrans, who kept complaining that he had to report to Ulysses Grant. And Lincoln's response was that Rosecrans was the only human being he ever saw who could strut sitting down. So there were a lot of just sort of very pithy sort of understandings through humor that Lincoln had. You don't see them in the great final speeches. You do see them a bit in some of the letters that he wrote to people while he was president, and you see it all over the Lincoln-Douglas debates, where he would sort of enliven a crowd that way.
And do you think that that is something that he he did in a conscious way because he knew that that could be disarming in a sense, and that it it made him out to be just sort of an average guy?
Well, there are many accounts of this. It was a Western style of discourse, the sort of tall tale, the sort of the back flapper, the knee flapper. Lincoln enjoyed that mode. I think it was the way that he relaxed a little bit. It also, you can see his inventiveness in language there, too, because many of the jokes were or old ones that he would revitalize with a change of phraseology. One of the things we know about Lincoln, which is also a quality that a lawyer has to have, is that he was a very, very good listener. When a client walks into your office, they have a complaint. The question is whether that complaint can be translated into a legal problem. And so Lincoln learned how to listen to what people were actually saying to him, and he took advice on his writing, on all his speeches. The famous example is of how William Seward, his Secretary of State, had criticisms of the first inaugural address and gave him suggestions. And Lincoln took many of them but transformed them into his own language in a way that in every case made the point in a better way than Seward had presented it to him. So there's another example of how Lincoln was a very good wordsmith and how he labored over his prose to make it as good as he possibly could. He was his own speechwriter, which, of course, we don't generally have today.
Another caller here in Charleston, Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I...
Can you speak up?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess my phone's not functioning correctly. But I have one thing that I think it should always be aware of is that sometimes that a famous poet talked to me one time about how people interpreted his poems in rather unique ways, in that they often found very interesting techniques about him that he was totally not aware of. And he said sometimes people just read into things that aren't there. And I think we always have to have that caveat when we, especially famous people, we want to, we have a tendency to overdo what they might be doing and putting a flair on it that might not have had any resemblance to what Lincoln was really trying to say or what his implications, what he was doing at the time. And I'd like to hear you comment about that. Thank you.
All right. Well, I assume I guess that's a problem with any kind of literary criticism, I suppose.
Well, it's an interesting point. What I argue is that we know that Lincoln memorized certain speeches. We know that he was so deeply read in the Bible that he could summon up just about anything that he wanted to. We know as well that he worried a great deal about giving a good speech, knew that he didn't know how to do it as a young man, and therefore studied certain forms. And like many another autodidact, a self-educated man, I think he used the forms effectively but creatively. Did he think about them all the time? I don't think so. But if you've been before 5,000 juries and judges with a certain mode of expressing yourself, it sort of becomes automatic in many ways. And to give you an example, the Gettysburg Address, the first paragraph is about the past, the second paragraph is about the present, and the third paragraph is about the future. That is the way every legal argument proceeds in court, where you first identify what happened in the past, second, try to explain what that means in terms of a present determination, and third, all right, what do we do about it? Did Lincoln consciously think this is a legal document that I must put in that form? Probably not. But what I think he did do was realize that the United States was his client on this day, and that he had to speak for it in a way that would get Americans to understand the country in a very different way. So one of the things he does is trace the origin of the country to the Declaration of Independence instead of the Constitution. That's a very conscious choice on his part, because it means that he's looking at a country defined by equality, one country in which secession is not a possibility, instead of the Constitution at 1787, which is a collection of states with a rather weak central federal authority at the time. That's a deliberate choice on his part and an adroit kind of take. When people comment on that, I think they have to say that Lincoln was very much aware of what he was doing.
And just very quickly, the how you factor in Lincoln's personality. This is something that also that you touch on, the idea that he had a dark nature, perhaps, that he was someone who struggled with depression, and given the kind of stresses and the situation of the country at the time, I guess we wouldn't. We could understand that.
He had reasons to be upset.
He had reasons to be upset. But that was something that informed his presentation.
Well, the thing that he was known for as a lawyer in a profession where there's a lot of prevarication was that he was known amongst other lawyers on the circuit and judges for his honesty, so much so that when a judge was unavailable, they would generally appoint Lincoln to preside over a case. This is now prevented later in the century, but it was a familiar form in the middle of the 19th century, and particularly in the West. And so people knew they could trust this man to do the right thing. The epithet Honest Abe was hardly earned and dearly won. And I think Lincoln prized that, I think, as much as anything. I think what one sees in the great speeches, whether you agree with him or not, is sincerity on his part. Hmm.
Well, there we will have to stop. Just one more time, mention for the benefit of people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana that our guest for this hour, Robert Ferguson, he is professor of law, literature, and criticism at Columbia University, will be here at the end of the week on Friday to take part in a symposium, Lincoln and Cultural Value. There will be four different speakers who will address different aspects of Lincoln. And our guest, Professor Ferguson, will be speaking on Lincoln's rhetorical style, the title he's put on his talk, Hearing Lincoln and the Making of Eloquence. This will be taking place at the Levis Center in the Music Room Friday, 9 to 4, and he is the first speaker, and it's open to the public and free. Anybody who is interested in stopping by should feel welcome. And Professor Ferguson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed talking with you.